You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. Thank you all very much for joining us for today's conversation on recent trends in democracy and development in the emerging world. My name is Homi Karas. I'm the director of the Global Economy and Development Program at Brookings, and we're delighted to host this event jointly with CPEC, the Center for the Implementation of Public Policies for Equity and Growth in Argentina. So I think it's particularly appropriate that we are having this event today. It's Halloween. Halloween is a day where there are some things that are scary and hopefully some things that are less so. And it seems to me that democracy is falling squarely into that particular vein. A bunch of scary things happening. Kind of interesting and almost unthinkable that, you know, we've got to the stage where major events like COP25 and the APEC summit have been canceled because in many ways of the failure of democracy to actually deal with issues. Riots in Chile have cost to date something on the order of $1.4 billion. This is happening in the country that for many years was thought of as being the most stable democratic place in Latin America. So across the world, I think we have these kind of this sense that things are moving in a very new and very different way than they did in the past. And it's important, of course, not just because of democracy and the fact that accountability and people's how people think about their ability to influence their own lives is affected by these processes, but also by the impact that this can have on economic growth and development. And I spent a lot of my career working on East Asia. And people used to say, what's the secret to East Asia's economic success? And some people would talk about export-oriented, manufacturing and things like that. But ultimately, people would always come back to the politics. And they would say, the thing about East Asia that is different from the rest of the world is that in East Asia, ultimately, if you want to know how a policy issue is going to be resolved, it's going to be resolved in terms of what benefits economic growth. That's going to be the driver of political change. And people relied on that. I think if you were to ask that question today, I don't think you would get the same answer, either in East Asia or anywhere else in the world. And so this is perhaps one of the big conundrums. How do we actually think about democracy, think about the effect that it's having on economic growth and development, and how do we really understand all of these movements that we see so visibly on the streets across the world? So there's a huge amount of what I would call armchair analysis of these kinds of issues, and much less actual scrutiny of the data of people's opinions about democracy. And so we're particularly delighted to have here Richard Wyke, the director of Global Attitudes Research from the Pew Research Center, who actually has been conducting a number of polls on people's attitudes towards democracy. What we're going to do this morning is Richard is going to start with some descriptions of some recent polls, including some quite recent polls on, this is the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, so particular interest in what's happening in Europe. So he'll start with that and then moderate a panel. I'll leave it to him to introduce the panelists as they come up, but essentially to cover Latin America, Africa, and South Asia. So I'm looking forward to a really interesting conversation. Richard, floor is yours for some introductory comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Homi, and thanks to Brookings and to CPEC for organizing and hosting this. Thanks to our terrific panelists who will join me up on the stage in just a few moments. Thanks to all of you for being here. Lots of people in D.C. are a little groggier than normal today, after all, after watching the Nats triumph in Game 7 of the World Series. So thanks for, yes, go Nats. Thanks for making it out this morning to be here. I'm really happy to be a part of this discussion, and I look forward to moderating our discussion in just a few minutes. But as Homi said, I'll sort of start things off by sharing some of the public opinion research that we've done around the world at Pew, looking at attitudes towards democracy to sort of set the stage for our conversation. To me, when we look at the trajectory of democracy around the world, it's really important to understand public attitudes about democracy. What do people think about democratic principles? Are they satisfied or dissatisfied with the way democracy is functioning in their countries? Of course, as we all know, there's been a lot of discussion over the last few years about the health of democracy around the world. If you look at places like Freedom House, the Economist Intelligence Unit, International IDEA, organizations like these, I think, have done a great job of tracking some troubling trends when it comes to the health of democracy. They've identified a number of places where we've seen democratic backsliding. And if you look at public opinion studies, they too, I think, have identified some troubling trends in some cases, maybe some places where support for democracy is waning a bit, or at the very least, instances where commitment to democracy among average citizens isn't as strong as we might think or as we might hope. So let me jump in a little bit and share with you just a couple of slides on some data we've collected at Pew that I think highlight some of these issues, including maybe a less of a commitment to democracy among average citizens than we sometimes think. And I'm going to start off by showing you some data from a study we conducted back in 2017 in 38 countries around the world. And so all these numbers you see here are median percentages across those 38 countries. And basically what we did is we asked people about five different regime types or five different approaches to government. And these were modeled on some questions that you may have seen before from something called the World Values Survey, although we changed the questions a little bit. You know, first of all, we asked them about representative democracy. Do you think that's a good or a bad way of governing our country? And what we see is that people overwhelmingly say it's a good thing. They like direct representative democracy. A median of 78% across these 38 nations say that's a good way to govern. They also like direct democracy. A median of 66% say a system in which average citizens decide on major laws rather than elected officials is a good way to govern. And I think that reflects what we've seen in many parts of the world in recent years, which is maybe a renewed interest in participatory democracy and things like that. Certainly, direct democracy has been a part of some of the populist parties we've seen active in Europe and elsewhere. So, you know, this kind of picks that up. People are very interested in direct democracy, and many think it's a good way to govern. We also see a fair amount of support for non-democratic alternatives as well. So we ask about a system in which experts rule rather than elected officials, and publics are almost evenly divided when it comes to whether or not that's a good idea or a bad idea. We also ask about a strong leader model, where you've got a strong leader who doesn't have to bother, essentially, with parliaments or courts. And this is less popular. Still, across these countries, you've got a median of 26% who say, this is a good way to govern, could be a good way to govern. The least popular model that we tested is military rule. Still, you've got almost a quarter essentially saying military rule could be a good approach. And if you look across nations, you do see more support for some of these non-democratic approaches in emerging and developing countries. But you also see substantial minorities in many advanced economies, in many countries that have been labeled in the past as consolidated democracies. So if you look at something like military rule even, I believe the number is 17% in France, 17% in Italy, 17% here in the United States who say that that could be a good way to govern. So nearly one in five Americans saying military rule could be a good approach, which is in some ways a pretty stunning number, but it's also very consistent with what other surveys have shown. So you, looking across these various measures, to us, I think, reflected the fact that representative democracy is a popular idea. People tend to embrace it, but perhaps a surprising number are open to other approaches to government as well. And this is a separate set of questions. This is data from 2015. We actually have some new data on all these questions that we will have available in early 2020. So if you're interested, you know, stay tuned for that. But this is a battery of questions where we essentially read people a list of six democratic rights and institutions. And for each one, we ask them, how important is it to have this in your country? So as you can see here, we've got religious freedom, gender equality, competitive elections, free speech, media freedom, freedom on the internet. And when we ask these questions, what we typically see is that big majorities say these things are at least somewhat important. And these are median percentages across 38 countries that we polled all around the world. When you look at the very important numbers, however, they're a little lower, right? And if you look at the three different forms of free expression, you've only got about half or a little bit more than half saying that these things are very important. So, again, thinking about democratic commitment, what you see is that, you know, there's a decent number of people out there who say these things are somewhat important, but not necessarily high priorities. And when we ask these questions, we do also see some differences across countries and across regions, and that's what you can see a little bit of here. So this is our three questions on forms of free expression, free speech, freedom of the press, being able to say what you want without censorship on the internet. And this is the share of the public in these regions as well as the United States saying that it's very important to have these things in our country. So you can see in the U.S., there tends to be relatively high support, about 7 in 10 or so saying these things are very important to have in our country. Pretty high support in Latin America, a relatively high support across the 10 EU countries we polled that year. And then you can see lower levels of support in the Asia-Pacific region as well as in Africa and the Middle East. So, again, thinking about what this tells us, looking across all these measures, I think it highlights the fact that maybe commitment to democracy isn't always as strong as we might think. You know, on the one hand, looking at those other questions, people like representative democracy, but many are open to non-democratic approaches as well. When it comes to democratic principles, again, people tend to embrace them, but they don't always say it's very important. They aren't always strongly committed to those principles. And I think this lack of commitment in some ways in public opinion can potentially open up space for illiberal political actors, would-be authoritarians. It gives them some space, essentially, to operate. One other thing I'll mention that we've seen in our data over the last few years is that even among people who are committed strongly to liberal democratic values, they're often unhappy with how democracy is actually working in their country. We did a study last year where we tried to look at what's driving dissatisfaction with democracy and how it's performing in nations around the world. And we, you know, learned that, as you might expect, it's a lot of different things, right? It's in some cases economic factors. If you're unhappy with the current economy, you're more likely to be unhappy with the way democracy is working. If you don't think that there are good opportunities to improve your standard of living, you're more likely to be dissatisfied with how democracy is working. But there are also some explicitly political factors as well. If you think that politicians are mostly corrupt in your country, you're more dissatisfied. If you think that politicians and political elites don't listen to average citizens, don't care what average citizens think, you're more likely to be dissatisfied with how democracy is functioning in your country as well. So there's a lot of things driving the unhappiness many people feel about the way democracy is working. And then one final thing I'll mention that Homi already alluded to is that at Pew we released a report a couple of weeks ago looking at public opinion in Europe, 3 decades after the fall of communism. And, you know, one thing it showed is that if you look at the former communist nations in Central and Eastern Europe, overall among publics there, there are few regrets about the end of the communist era. However, as they look back across the last 3 decades, they also think that progress has been uneven, and they think that some people have benefited much more from all of the changes in society than others. And I think this sense of unfairness about the way political systems are operating is something that's pretty clear from our data in Central and Eastern Europe, and I think maybe some of these same frustrations could be a factor in the other regions that we're going to talk about today. So I look forward to discussing that with our panelists, and I welcome all of you up to the stage. Thanks. Terrific. Great. Thank you. I think we're all mic'd up now. We look forward to having a conversation here on the stage for a little bit, and then we'll open things up to the floor and take questions from the audience as well. So we're really fortunate to have 3 great panelists here today. I think you have handouts with all their full bios, so I won't run through all their accomplishments here, but just sort of briefly introduce them. Irfan Nuruddin is a professor at the Walsh School of Foreign Policy down the street at Georgetown University. Julia, you came from a little farther away. Julia Palmares is executive director of CPEC, which has been mentioned, a think tank based in Buenos Aires. And then Landry Signe from the African Growth Initiative here at Brookings is also a David Rubenstein Fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program here. And welcome all of you. Let me start off by asking our panelists to maybe just provide an overview of what you think about democratic trends in the various regions that you focus on. And in particular, maybe focus on what has happened in terms of the big elections in the region and what that tells us or doesn't tell us about democratic trends in the region or around the world. So, Leonard, let me start with you. Obviously, we've had some big elections in the past year in South Africa. Maybe start there. Tell us what we've learned from that, and how does it speak to broader democratic trends in the region?
Thank you very much for the question. I would first like to thank Sebastian for organizing such a timely event on a critical topic. So perhaps before speaking about the case of South Africa, I would like to present a broader overview of the situation in Africa in general. So we have seen a substantial increase of accountability and citizen demand for democracy on the continent. For example, According to an Afrobarometer survey, about 77% of Africans demand democracy. About 75% want a two-term limit, and over 53% would prefer accountable governments compared to non-accountable governments, but with faster decision-making processes. So overall, most African citizens, according to Afrobarometer surveys, will prefer accountable government over efficient government. So that is one important point. The second point also that I would like to highlight is the fact that as of 1988, over 94% of African countries were undemocratic. And if we just look at the past 5 years, about 55% of the leaders in sub-Saharan Africa have changed. So this is, and 50% of those change through meaningful and democratic elections. So I think those are some progress which are not often highlighted. So, of course, I may be discussing, so that demand for democracy is driven also by accountability. If you take, for example, the imperative of vertical accountability, so which means free, fair, transparent, and meaningful elections, so the selection of leadership through those criteria, of course, requiring a minimal level of political rights, civil liberties, among order. Countries such as South Africa, Benin, Sao Tome and Principe, Lesotho, Liberia, or Sierra Leone have came to a change of leadership through free and fair election, to equality, vertical accountability. When we discuss horizontal accountability, which means checks and balances, if you look, the case of South Africa will be telling. Zuma had to resign given the corruption scandal. As a matter of fact, elections were organized in May, and the ANC received his lowest score with a little bit over 57%. We have also seen a substantial decrease of the Democratic Alliance, which was elected, which received only 20.8% of the vote, where we have seen a substantial increase of extremist political parties. For example, EFF, the Economic Freedom Front, won 10.8%, up from 6.4%. Or the Freedom Front Plus also won 2.4%. So we are seeing the increase of extremist political party. Now, of course, in the case of South Africa, we have a few challenges, especially the question of governance with corruption, the ESCOM scandal, but we also have the question of human capital, job creation, among other, over 27% of the population doesn't have a quality job, let alone the level of education, among other challenges. We can also speak about women rights. During the World Economic Forum that I attended on Africa in September, so many protesters came to contest the way women are treated, violence against women. So this is the case of South Africa. Now, if I discuss a little bit also in Nigeria, elections were delayed due to violence. We had conflicts, of course, you have Boko Haram, but also the conflict between herdsmen and farmers. And the case of Nigeria is where the incumbent won is quite telling because, as you know, Nigeria is the largest African economy and has numerous challenges. Of course, Boko Haram, you have extreme poverty. So according to some of the estimate by my colleague and leader, Homi Karasi here, so Nigeria is hosting the highest proportion of extreme poor people. And we have also the separatist movement in the Biafra region, among other factors. More than 94 million of people in Nigeria live under below poverty line, extreme poverty line. So having said that, despite the challenges, we have seen changes in countries such as Zimbabwe, although the departure of Mugabe had left the room to another, not more accountable leader. And perhaps let me highlight a positive development in the case of Kenya, for example, where the Supreme Court had to cancel the elections, although the incumbent was supposed to have won. So I think overall those are some of the trends that we have. I am not certain, although in individual conversation, including some leader will tend to reject the question of democracies and accountability, taking for illustration cases such as Rwanda or Ethiopia, which are economic outperformers per some of the indicators, there is still a clear demand for democracy in Africa, and this is growing, at least according to Afrobarometer studies. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, Julia, you've had some interesting developments in Argentina of late, right? There have been elections there. There have been contested elections recently in Bolivia, a lot of upheaval in Chile. You know, start off where you want, but give us a sense of what's happening in Latin America and how can we make sense of it?
I will first start by thanking Sebastian and Homi for having the opportunity of organizing and working on this together. Thank you very much. It was a very intense electoral calendar this year, and actually last Sunday, well we have a round off in Uruguay, but it's almost ended after 6 presidential elections this year. And if you start the cycle from mid-2017, that is the start of the presidential cycle in Latin America, we had 12 elections. So I think there is a big trend that you can first take out of those elections is that you cannot say that we have now a trend towards the right or the left, but we have a trend towards punishing incumbents. And I think that's quite an important trend, that it's quite different from what we had over the last wave of elections in Latin America. We used to have longer electoral cycles, and we start having shorter, or at least this seems to be the start of a shorter electoral cycle, where the electorate, and especially the middle class, are angry, discontent, because of the slow economic performance, and starts punishing incumbents. We had, except for Bolivia, Venezuela, and Honduras, with a lot of problems in those elections, irregularities, changes in the constitution. In those 3 countries, incumbents were re-elected, but it's very, very different what is going on from the other countries. And we had, and the second trend is that we have the punishment in the ballots, and also we have people in the streets. At other times in history, I think we tend to go for one or the other. Now we have the two together, and I think that it's a novelty of these days, especially after what you were saying, that Chile, probably Chile is the most surprising situation, because it's a, I think it's quite different from other countries in Latin America. Chile is very paradigmatic in many ways, in the economic growth, in the stability of democracy, in the rule of law, improvements over the return to democracy. The Chilean case, I think, deserves some separate attention. I think if you could say Argentina, it's getting to the limits of having inclusion without growth. Chile went to the limitations of having growth without inclusion. And now we are debating how, and we were talking with Homi this morning, if it's this is going to be the end of a model, of a successful model, or it's just the natural consequence of the model that we have a bigger middle class that it's having more demands, and Chile used to have a poverty rate of 40% and now has a poverty rate of 8%, so more than 30% of people are now not hungry, are asking for more public services, and I think it's no coincidence that in many countries in Latin America where all these demonstrations are taking place are after an increase in the public transport fares or the energy fares. So it has to do with the quality of public services. And I think it tells you a lot about what are the challenges ahead.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you. And Irfan, thinking about India, obviously 2019 has been a big year for elections there. Many of you may have seen The Economist last week, I believe it was, had a special report on India, and was a pretty pessimistic take on what might lie ahead for a second term for Modi. So, what can you say about what these elections mean in terms of democracy in India, maybe for South Asia, or are there some broader global trends that we can see reflected in what's happening in India as well?
Great. So I'm going to advance three propositions generally for the sake of provocation and conversation as we go forward. So let's start with South Asia. South Asia, I think, represents both the bright spot for democracy around the world in the sense that multi-party competitive elections are carried out across the region and have now for a while. But it is also, in a sense, sort of the canary in the mineshaft, if you would, of the problems with democracy in the developing world writ large. So this probably reveals more about my college career than I want to, but right, think about having your college friend who went out 7 days a week, came home at 3 a.m. every night and managed somehow to be no worse for the wear, and 25 years later is still trying to do that and now recovers a little slower, gets up a little later, looks a little worse around the eyes, and you suspect that the liver is about to fail at any moment. I think that's South Asia, right? I mean, in that we praised South Asia so much about the democracy because it represented for us, I think, in the 1990s, an example of a developing region, in India in particular, that was able to get competitive electoral democracy instantiated while ignoring the fact that the public institutions of each of these countries, whether it was the courts, whether it was media, whether it was the rules governing civil society, were being undermined from within, such that the supporting tissue, the liver, if you would, right, in this very terrible analogy of mine, right, was essentially being weakened. And now for us to sort of look and suddenly say, why is it that in Pakistan, 70 years after holding elections, we still don't have successful transfers of power from civilian government to civilian government, and even with Imran Khan in power, there are very few Pakistan observers I know of in Washington or elsewhere who actually think that the military is not really in charge and that the military's role in Pakistan's society has become, in fact, if anything, greater in the last few years than it used to be. Why is it that in Bangladesh, where we have competitive elections, those elections are increasingly characterized by violence against candidates and supporters, and you have an incumbent now who's in her third term, that's typically a bad sign when people are winning three consecutive terms. They tend to not want to give up power the fourth time around. In Sri Lanka, we have an election coming up that everyone expects will be along ethnic lines in ways that might return Sri Lanka to really terrible days. And finally, you have India, right, which in many ways is, of course, still, and I want to make sure I say this clearly, still, I think, a paragon of virtue in terms of competitive elections, right? In May, we had this election at the national level that led to Prime Minister Modi coming back with a tremendous majority. But yet, this last week, two states, Haryana and Maharashtra, where the BJP, his party, had been in power, went to the polls, and the same voters who 5 months ago had given the BJP a huge national mandate, the party lost seats in both states, right? Voters are sophisticated enough to be able to distinguish between national and state elections, and even what appears to be a behemoth, right, in the BJP, loses seats in competitive elections at the state level. So the Economist, right, berating Mr. Modi is sort of interesting, because in 2014, Modi was their poster child. He was what was going to bring economic reform, the Gujarat model, and we very conveniently ignored the fact that until 3 months before Modi was elected in 2014, he was on a no-visa list for the United States. I mean, we had the potential that a prime minister of India would have been denied a U.S. visa for the previous 10 years because of his alleged complicity in anti-Muslim riots in the state for which he was chief minister. And then he wins. The Economist puts him on the cover. President Obama embraces him, right? Walks him around the MLK Memorial, et cetera, which is all fine. That's diplomacy. But the notion that we should suddenly be surprised that 5 years later, anti-minority prejudice is on the rise, that Hindu majoritarianism is on the rise, that the media is being cracked down against, that civil society suggests to me a failure of memory that is pretty unconscionable when we come to analysis. So just to wrap this up, I think this is true then of the developing world writ large, and maybe, like I said, for provocation and conversation. I wrote a book a couple of years ago with Tom Flores and George Mason called Elections in Hard Times, where we analyzed every competitive national election, and competitive very broadly understood, right? There were more than two parties that were allowed to compete. It didn't have to be a fair election, it didn't have to be a free election, but there were at least two parties allowed to be on the ballot. And we analyzed every election since 1945. It's available on Amazon in case you're looking for Christmas gifts for friends and family, right? But what is true across the developing world is that we have undermined the ability for incumbents to run for elections on the basis of the kinds of things we know are good for democracy, programmatic appeals based on policy platforms, et cetera, right? These are states that are largely bankrupt, that are impoverished in terms of their fiscal space, that are recovering from violent conflicts domestically. And what the democracy promotion industry has done has gone out and say, hold a competitive election as quickly as you can, right? And let's hope it all goes really well, right? We'll send a couple of monitors. We'll advise you on how to set up your electronic voting machines, how to get voter rolls going. And guess what? In the intervening 5 years after the monitors have left and before they come back for the next election, these are governments that are looking around and they don't have a budget with which to build schools. They don't have budgets with which to build infrastructure. They're laden with structural adjustment programs from the IMF and others that push fiscal austerity. They become members of the WTO and have to cut trade taxes, which is the one thing developing countries know how to collect. When governments don't have the money to spend on big public policies, but still have to win an election, they use other tactics. They use patronage to their kinship groups. They give out pork, as it were. And when that fails, they harass, they intimidate, and when all of that fails, they steal elections outright. In other words, maybe we should be thinking really not about whether or not, I mean, then this research is fabulous, so this is not a criticism of that, but not in the sense whether individual citizens in these poor countries around the world are trying to figure out what democracy means, are committed or not, or whether or not the elections are free and clear, but whether or not the rules of the game in the international system have been rigged against any possibility of success for the consolidation of democracy in the developing world. So I don't know whether that's a complete Halloween, like it really, really pessimistic, or maybe, you know, for the sake of optimism, that what we know worked in the developed world is that it was the consolidation of states, it was state building that preceded democratization. What we're doing in the developing world by necessity is trying to build states at the same time as we build democracies. That's what we've got to do. I'm okay with that. But we need to think about how to support them in doing that, how to actually take the development part of democracy and development as seriously as we do the democracy part. Or I think we set them up for failure.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, you highlight some important ways that state building, the institutions play in making sure that democracies are healthy, right? Another type of institution that is widely viewed as being important to the success of a democracy, right, are political parties, right? And, you know, in various parts of the world, party systems have been in upheaval. If you look at Europe, you know, some of the traditional parties have fallen away, new parties have arisen, party systems have fractionalized and things like that. What role, and I'll stick with you, Irfan, sure, for just a moment, then, in thinking about the institutional mix that a democracy needs, what role do political parties play? You know, what do we know about the health of political parties in South Asia? And then, you know, generally, where are political parties at in either encouraging or not encouraging democratization in emerging nations?
One of the canonical works in political science is a book from 1968 by Sam Huntington. Those of us who follow democracy know him maybe for the book he wrote in 91 called The Third Wave of Democratization. But in 68, he wrote a book called The Political Order of Changing Societies, in which he argued, quite controversially for the time, that the introduction of democracy in a lot of these newly decolonized countries was going to cause chaos because essentially people were going to come in the streets and they were not going to have avenues by which to represent their views, to channel those in ways that were peaceful and productive for democracy. So when I see that high support for direct democracy in your slides, I channel Huntington and say that's not a good sign, right? That in fact representative party-based democracy, which is Huntington's analysis, is really what has kept countries like India, the strong Congress party in its early years after independence, essentially on a democratic track. So I guess that's my way of saying I think parties are critical. I don't think we can think about democracy without strong political parties and party-based competition. And by that measure, I think this is another place where we need to be concerned. In South Asia, we have parties that have turned into personalist vehicles. I mean, in India, you know, it's a bit of a joke as to the number of parties that contest any national election, thousands upon thousands. The average number of parties in every district in the parliamentary elections is over 10, right? It's the same exact electoral system as America's, right? It's a first-past-the-post, whoever gets a plurality wins. In America, that has resulted in two parties competing in every election. In India, there's 10 different parties in every district because each party becomes a vehicle for me, right? It's my party, it's for me, and then it'll be for my wife, and then it'll be for my son, and then it'll be for my son's wife, and we'll hand it down over generations. That means that no, the basis for party loyalty, right, becomes much more personal than it does ideological and programmatic. And I think one of the things that we need to challenge ourselves on is that ideology kind of got a bad rap in the 90s and 2000s. We wanted these pragmatic technocrats who would go make good policy. But ideology is what binds parties, and parties are what support democracy. And so maybe we have to think about what kinds of ideology are we comfortable with as we go out and support and build parties in the developing world.
Mm-hmm. Landry, you referenced, I think, in South Africa, you know, sort of lower vote shares for ANC, maybe compared to what they used to get. There's, as I understand it, been some divisions within the DA, the biggest opposition party in South Africa in recent months. What do you say about the health of democracies and the health of political parties in Africa? Are there any trends we can talk about? Do you see the same problem with parties becoming too personalized around individual leaders, or what's your assessment?
As a matter of fact, parties have always been overly personalized on the continent. We are seeing now an increase or a multiplication of political party. And you highlighted a very important point, the lack of programmatic parties, political bodies, and mostly ethnically motivated or ideologically motivated. So those are some of the trends that we have on the continent. In fact, we are in countries such as Benin, for example, leadership change occur with an outsider. So we often see outsider coming. So unless we have a more institutionalized political party in a given country or a variety of political parties, I think African democracies will remain quite unstable. Now, coming back to one of the points that you mentioned about the relation between state building and democracy, I think I've conducted a study at the Stanford Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law, and looking at Africa as an experiment. There's no clear connection between what should come first, whether it's a strong state, whether it's economic development or democracy. So what we have seen on the continent is that we can have, ideally, and I deeply believe that quality institution and state capacity are critical, no matter if the country is democratic or authoritarian, because public services and goods have to be delivered to citizens, so independently of the nature of the political regime. So I guess in the case of Africa, I would say, yes, of course, we need support to strengthen state capacity and to reduce the gap between policy formulation and implementation and implementation outcome. But however, I think that it is not, I don't say that it's what you meant, I don't think that it's either or, because authoritarian regimes are very oppressive. And sometimes weak state is your only mean to remain indefinitely in power. So sometimes state failure or fragile state are the fact of political leaders trying to keep power indefinitely. So I think it is important to contextualize, at least in the African case, yes, we need more support to state capacity, whether it's the independent of the nature of the political regime. But on the other hand, it is important to make progress toward democracy or at least a better representativity of the citizens. Mm. Citizens are anyway demanding for it.
Yeah, yeah. And Julia, it'd be great to hear from you on the health of political parties or democratic institutions generally in Latin America. I also wanted to pick up on one really interesting thing you said a moment ago, which is that kind of two different things are happening, right? Like governments are being punished at the ballot box and people are getting into the streets too, right? And you see that obviously in Chile, other parts of the world recently, Lebanon, Hong Kong, elsewhere. There's protests happening that are getting a lot of attention. So I'm interested in those are all driven by maybe different factors in different countries, but are there some commonalities too? Is there anything you see that like is happening in, say, Chile, for example, that resonates in other parts of the world? And how effective are these protests? How effective are these instances in which people pour into the streets to try to bring about change? So take any of that you like.
Okay. I was thinking of what you were saying about more sophisticated voters, and I think that the same is going on in Latin America, because you had voters punishing incumbents, but also doing more split-ticket voting and having minority governments in Congress. So voters are getting much more sophisticated, and to put it quite provocatively, political parties are not getting that sophisticated in a way. So we have an imbalance there, where political parties and the ways in which representation is being channeled is not being up to the task. And I think that what we are discussing in Chile is that we have now electoral participation in Chile at 45%, almost half of what is electoral participation in Argentina, for example. So low levels of people are going to the ballot, and also we are having political parties that look to be quite unrooted from society. So I think there is a problem in political representation. And so when you have moments of economic growth, well, probably that is not that important. But when you are facing deep problems, as we are facing now or starting to face now, you need better representation. So that would be my first thought about that. And I think the other one is about this kind of impressive thing that we are seeing, kind of as Homi was saying this morning, collective action. So there's not coordination for climate change of governments, but there's coordination of people in the streets, that they all go to the streets at the same time in different places. So what can we tell about that? I think it's probably too early to tell, so I won't take the risk of saying how that is taking place. We know that social media and it's obviously playing a part, but I think that there is quite evident that Latin America is facing all over the rest of the world the problems of coordination. So we're not having help from outside. Problems are very personalistic. Leaders in the most important countries discussing on Twitter. So there is a problem in the international order, and people in Latin America are starting to feel that they're a bit fell behind. So I think that there's probably some diffusion and replication of social demonstrations that is taking place, and at least in Argentina and in Uruguay, we are seeing what is going on in Chile, and we start thinking, well, maybe this is also important to take into account that something similar can happen soon. So I think there is an interesting trend to look at how this coordination take place and how, even if it's not coordination, but at least this diffusion and transmission from one country to another one.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting to think about sort of a sophistication gap, as you kind of mentioned, right, between the voters on the one hand and these ossified political parties, and on another hand, and political parties being unable maybe to keep up with some of the changes happening in society and happening politically, one of which is... Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
I think there is something to take into account that I forgot, is that we had an increase in middle classes in Latin America that by about, I think, 50% from 2003 to 2009. In just 6 years, according to a World Bank report, the amount of middle class people in Latin America has expanded very, very strongly. So I think that is obviously part of the equation. We have more and more people that they have a job, but they spend 2 hours to get to their job on a very bad public transport. They have problems sending their schools, their kids to public schools because they have very low quality, so they struggle to get a private school. They have problems with their health insurance because the hospital in their village is not of a good quality. So you have a better income, but that doesn't mean that you have a better well-being in all the other dimensions. And I think that is part of the problem now. Mm.
Their expectations have risen.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think, so I appreciated the pushback, and I agree. I mean, no part of what I said should be taken to mean that this is an endorsement of some sort of crude sequencing, right? Let's suspend democracy till we've got the development piece set. Let's suspend democracy till we have state building. But I think we need to come to terms with the fact that the conditions under which we're asking developing countries to democratize in the current era are unlike anything for which we have successful precedent. So two facts, again, reported in the book I mentioned. One is, think about the post-conflict experience, right? At this point in time, by the data that Tom Flores and I collected, one out of every four elections happening at the national level anywhere in the world is happening in a post-conflict or conflict environment. Right, there's either an active armed militancy happening somewhere in the country, or you're within 5 years of having had an armed insurgency, a civil war in your country. The idea that we can go from that to competitive elections that are going to be consolidatable, right, that we can consolidate, that are going to be long-lasting, as opposed to elections that are likely to replicate the ethnic and other cleavages that had led to the conflict in the first place, seems overly optimistic, if not outright naive, right? And yet that's exactly what we've asked these countries to do. When I talk about state capacity, I want to make it very concrete. I'm not talking about strong states, because strong states can be strong police forces, they can be the use of the military, etc. I want to think about fiscal capacity, right? So again, these data are not perfect because we don't do a great job as a development community in being able to get a great access to tax data, but to the best of our ability, we collected tax data, we normalized them, we corrected for currency fluctuations, for interest rates, et cetera, right? So take that for what it's worth. By 2010, the average OECD country, including the United States, has an average per capita tax revenue approximating $10,000, right? Between $8,000 and $10,000. This is 10 years ago. The average country in sub-Saharan Africa had a tax per capita revenue of $150. In Sierra Leone, and again, these data are spotty, they're not perfect, but in Sierra Leone, by our calculations, if you start from when the civil war begins to the current period, the average tax revenues that the state was collecting and reporting was $1. Okay? Which is not to say that that's all the revenue. There's plenty of oil revenue, there's plenty of natural mineral revenue, but the state capacity to actually do things in public policy around which you build ideological political parties, around which you build programmatic policy, it has just been absolutely undermined. Latin America is interesting because Latin America, of course, is much richer when we just in terms of pure income. But I think it forces us to ask what is the scar tissue of the frequent economic crises that have buffeted this region. So if we think of Argentina, right? I don't know that we have great research, and maybe you can point me to it, but of what happens to attitudes, what happens to the ties that bind politicians to their citizens in ways that are good for democracy, if every 5 years, as you were saying, we can essentially date, do you remember that crisis, or are you talking about this crisis, right? Which currency crisis are we discussing? And the idea that citizens can experience these major shocks to their day-to-day life without it having an effect on how they think about the people who represent them, the parties that claim to have had their best interests, just, again, seems to me pretty atheoretical in ways that then lead us to be surprised when all of a sudden it appears that citizens are not enamored by some theoretical notion of competitive democracy. Why should they be?
So I do agree, but let's put in context the fact that without accountability, you will still have corruption. For example, when conducting some research, like there's a capacity problem in terms of tax collection, but there's also a corruption aspect. In some countries that I will not necessarily name, the tax general manager or director can offer a break of up to 30% to any taxpayer. The minister himself can offer a tax break of up to 80%. Now, what happened? Why don't we have enough resources? So, yes, I do agree that we have a challenge of capacity, but even with the actual capacity, what is the gap between the actual capacity and the outcome of what is collected? And I think part of what explains the underperformance is, of course, corruption and the limited rule of law, what I like to call rule by law. Sometimes you have clear rules, but leaders will be applying them to some and not order. Will be applying them with rigor to their opponent and not to their friend. So, yes, state capacity is clear, and I totally agree with you. We cannot do much without state capacity, whether you are a democracy or an authoritarian regime. However, if you don't have a certain form of accountability, even with state capacity, government will extract resources and direct them to your personal account versus serving public good.
Okay, great. Well, I want to make sure we have some time for folks in the audience to participate as well. So let's open it up for questions. And we've got plenty of hands already. Then we have some microphones circulating. So when you ask a question, please identify yourself. Keep the questions brief. And what we'll do is we'll collect three questions and give our panelists then a chance to respond. I think maybe we're starting off back here. Is that right? Not colleague. Yes.
Hi, I'm John Zemko with the Center for International Private Enterprise. As I'm listening to, you know, where we started about the polling on democracy and how people feel about democracy in general, for those of us who've been working in this world of democracy development for quite a few years, I've begun to ask myself, do we really know enough? We know how people feel about democracy or lack thereof, but do we really know about how people feel about their democracies? Or how they understand their democracies, or their lack of democracy for that matter. And I'm wondering if we couldn't do collectively, the moderator and the panelists in particular, is there more that we need to do in the international community to understand what lacks in these democracies to help bring that understanding, not just about how they feel about the term, but how they understand the term in their context?
Yeah, thank you, okay. Let's get two more, maybe right here.
Thanks. I'm John Coonrod with the Hunger Project, and I'm a nut for decentralization. Development happens in communities. All politics is local, and having democracy that delivers really requires strong local governments, and Africa, other than Kenya, and Indian states, other than Kerala, maybe Tamil Nadu, have very weak local governments, very underfunded local governments. And so I just wonder, and this move to autocracy is re-centralizing a lot of power in a number of countries. So I'm wondering what any of you have seen in trends towards strengthening local governance and greater devolution of resources as a key to having democracy that can deliver.
I think maybe we have one more back over here. Is that right?
Hello. My name's Andre Goodfriend, a serving Foreign Service officer. In discussing democracy, I think there's we've talked about direct representation or representation of direct democracy, but what's missing perhaps is a definition of liberal democracy. With particularly in that either direct democracy or representative democracy could be liberal or not liberal, either majoritarian if it's, let's say, not liberal, or constrained by respecting the universality of human rights if it is liberal. In looking at the democracy in these various regions, there's and particularly with the growth of populism, which I think divides groups into an internal group and an external group, and talks about how we the people and our will should not be constrained by laws, that the will of the people should always be should always supersede laws, which is a growing trend in pushing for democracy. How is that reflected in the various studies that you've made in the various areas, as there is this push for what appears to be a majoritarian democracy that's particularist in its focus, rather than a more liberal democracy that's universalist with respect for human rights?
Great. All right, let's stop there, and we can take these three questions. Maybe should we start maybe with the last one about sort of majoritarian versus liberal conceptions of democracy? And I don't know, Julia, you want to take that and talk about what you see?
Definitely a very good point, and it was absent from our previous conversation. I tend to think that when we compare situations of polarization in some of our countries in Latin America, and say, well, it's quite similar to what is happening in the United States in terms of how polarization takes place on the social media and in the public discourse, we tend to forget that it's not the same to have polarization in a liberal democracy than in a democracy where the liberal component is very weak. And polarization is quite more dangerous when you don't have a very strong rule of law institutions. And my take building on what you were saying previously is that when you have the process of building a state at the same time of building the democratic institutions, we had the tendency of put more importance on the majoritarian part of the equation rather than on the liberal part of the equation. And I think what we are witnessing in several countries in Latin America, and we are seeing it now with the election results in Bolivia, for example, is that the liberal part of democracy is still very, very far away from being developed. And I think in this scenario of demonstrations in the streets and a lot of demands from the public, it's the tension grows, and I think it's quite complicated, and it will probably get more complicated in the future.
Yeah. And then maybe we can talk about decentralization. I don't know if Landry or Fran, if you have thoughts about, like, you know, what's happening at the local level.
I want to start, though, with your question. So, and I agree completely with what Julia said, but I want to use a different word, right, than liberal. Really, I think what we've understood at this point, and this is, I think, what animates our recognition that liberalism as a concept is what is missing in a lot of electoral democracies, is that the institutions that preserve liberalism are counter-majoritarian, right? That the reason that they do what they do, the reason that they can talk about the universality of human rights, is because they do not bow to popular pressure and therefore are not subject to the whims of majority opinion. That is when the courts do their job well, right? That is when the media does its job well. It punches up as opposed to punches down. It becomes a way to check government as opposed to. For populations, that's an incredibly sophisticated concept, right? We like to win. And if we've just won an election and our guys are in charge, we want them to be able to do a bunch of stuff. And if all of a sudden some court is telling them you can't do this, we get frustrated. It's not just in India. It is in advanced industrial democracies. It's here in the United States as well. The stakes of what it means to be counter-majoritarian have really been changed, though, because so much of this competition has become on the basis of identity politics, in terms of it becomes zero-sum as opposed to in terms of economic policy debates. So if you take India and the last election, right, Hindu majoritarianism was visible in the political campaign. That is both because the party had a particular campaign strategy, but also because on economic issues, there is very little daylight between the major parties, right? The signature policy achievement of the current government, what is called the goods and services tax, or GST, right, was developed by the previous government, right? And I can go down a list of 6 to 8 major initiatives that have literally just been named. I mean, they changed the acronym to include a different leader as opposed to the old leader in what they did. They don't disagree about cash transfers. They just disagree about how large the cash transfers would be, right? So, but when you're debating issues as to what the role of minorities, what is the identity of the nation, then there's zero sum. And then when the courts intervene, right, it becomes the stakes are just a great deal higher. And so I think we want to think about counter-majoritarianism. I think the devolution, your point, so is a very good one. And Anjali Bolkin, who's a professor at Georgia Tech, has written a book about, essentially about, I think it's called Democracy from Below, or, but essentially arguing that the, and has collected a global data set on decentralization reforms and the democratization of decentral. In India, we've seen, actually, I think we're going to see a stripping away of panchayat-level powers by the current government. But and so, which is, I think, troubling for public service delivery and last-mile delivery. But it's also the case that we have had this philosophy in India where the local elections are not partisan elections. You contrast that to the United States, where, you know, the joke is that all the way down to the dog catcher, there's a party ID. And there is something about learning party loyalty. There's some. So I guess maybe what I want to say is that the language of polarization has a dangerous slippery slope to arguing that we should not care about party labels, that those are problematic. We should all be some sort of notion of independence. We go for the best policy. We go for the best ideas. When in fact, parties, right, partisan polarization is what makes democracy work, as long as what they're organized around are things that are not easily construed as zero-sum, right, and that don't involve people as much as they involve ideas and the share of a budget. So different way of thinking about it.
So quickly, electoral versus liberal democracy. I think in most of the African countries, we have what I like to call, including democratic countries, hyper-presidentialism. Mm-hmm. So which means that we have elections, they may be free, fair, meaningful, but once elected, the leader may rule almost like in an authoritarian country. And this is partly explained by the weak horizontal accountability. So I have just published a book chapter on horizontal accountability and the challenge to democratic development in Africa. So that is one of the telling parts. Most of the president can do almost anything and they will not face the rigor or either the constitutional code or of the parliament. So a policy option could be to really empower and increase the autonomy of institutions such as parliament, Supreme Court, the judiciary in general. Yes, local development is critical, but on the other hand, it is important to also have quality leadership. Because as of now, we have local leaders who have budget, and although it is still asymmetrical, they are still not delivering to the extent of the budget that they receive. So we can also have a reproduction of the national dysfunctioning at the local level. So it's really important to build quality institution and capacity at the local level and not just expect that by decentralizing we will automatically have better outcomes. And finally, what people understand about democracy, I think that in some of the Afro barometer surveys, I was shocked to see that in some of the authoritarian countries, more than half of the population were thinking that they were in a democracy.
Yep.
So, so it is so, which means that education remain and political socialization remain critical.
Yeah, that's the thing we've seen in our surveys as well. Is that, let's say, people support free expression, but they define it very differently in different parts of the world, right? So some of them, what these principles mean sometimes really varies around the world. Okay, let's get maybe three more questions. Yeah, if we can get one, maybe you, and then you, sir, maybe one more in the back.
Andres Ortega, from El Cano Institute in Spain. I'm here a visiting fellow at the CSIS for some weeks. Just a question, leaving aside China, no? Do you think in your areas or in your countries, new technologies, especially IT technologies, have empowered more society and the people, or the government and the state?
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's get two more. I think the gentleman over here.
Good morning. My name is Julian Goldstein. I'm a junior international affairs major at Howard University, also a writer with the Political Review on campus. With respect to development and coupling that with democracy, I believe a source in the World Bank in about 2017-18 had cited that about 7 out of 10 of the world's fastest growing economies were all within the continent of Africa, partly tied to and related to investment from Chinese stakeholders. Could you discuss, particularly you, sir, on how when you talk about ideological trends within and shifting investment into the continent, as well as how the CFA franc plays a major consequence in lack of development throughout the Western region?
Great. Is there anyone else have a question they want to add? Yes.
Hi, my name is Laura. I work at IREX. My question is actually for Julia. What do you see the trends in the region are related to freedom of the press vis-a-vis the role of the press in the democratic process? Thank you.
Great. All right. Julia, you want to just start off with the last one here?
Okay, the last one. And also, I would like to say something about Andres. I will start with the new technologies. I definitely think that they are reshaping politics, at least in Latin America. And you were talking about local governments and devolution, and part of the local reaction is taking place on the social media. So I think all this debate about the role of local governments now is much more influenced by social media and new technologies, and actually more than probably national politics. We have people sending messages on WhatsApp about the services that are not working in their village, and there is a lot of demand. I think that it's also in the anxiety also is being increased by new technologies. There's a friend of us working in the creative sector that says that We wait no more than 45 seconds to answer a WhatsApp message from a friend. So if we cannot wait more than 45 seconds, so how are we going to expect that the government takes years to build a new highway in our village? So we are getting much more anxious, and I think that it's a problem, especially for local governments. And regarding, Laura, your question about freedom of the press, I don't think that the trend is very positive in some of the countries. I think that there are the social media and new technologies are pushing for more freedom of information and freedom of the press. But because many of the media outlets are being purchased and are owned by governments, there is still part of the deficit in the rule of law and liberal democracy, I think, has to do with the role of press, and especially with the cases of corruption that we haven't talked about corruption, but definitely still a very important problem in Latin America, and it's something that is also triggers demands when you are facing a bad economic situation. So I think that we have to keep looking at these trends very closely for the next years.
Then, Landry, there was a question about China and Africa, if you want to respond.
The Chinese presence in Africa, and I think we hosted the president of Guinea recently, and his point was he's open to capital coming from any country. So competition is healthy. I think the challenge is what African leaders do with those resources or the type of deal that they negotiate. Are they negotiating deals to serve the public goods, or are they negotiating bad deals to enrich themselves? I think that is probably one of the challenges. So, yes, Africa fast economic performance. You have seen the African Continental Free Trade Area, which was adopted last year, came into force this year, and country will start trading next year as of July. So definitively, new technologies are contributing also to the fast economic performance. Before, in the late 90s, New York City had more mobile phone subscribers than Africa, and now Africa has hundreds of million, has many, over 700 million mobile phone subscribers. So these are other important, which facilitate political protest. You have seen what happened in Sudan, for example, where the protest started with economic motivation, and given the increase of the cost of bread, something as basic as that, and given the lack of reaction of the government, become a political protest, which followed the model of political transition in Africa. And by the way, we have a political transition tracker at the Africa Growth Initiative, so you can look at it on our website, where since independence we have been monitoring leadership change on the continent. Related to France and CFA, of course, we have had many challenges in the past few years. But what is more important is the alternative proposed by African leaders. So we don't have a unique voice. For example, leaders such as the president of Chad will be voicing his concern and will be strongly opposed, where you have leaders such as the president of Senegal or the president of Cote d'Ivoire who will be promoting such a currency. It is critical for any country to control its monetary policy. So that is a matter of fact. Now, what are leaders doing to organize an appropriate transition? I think that remains a question of concern.
And Efren, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on the question about technology.
Sure.
You know, how is it impacting things in India or South Asia?
So again, you know, best of times, worst of times. I mean, in every village that I go to in India, there's now kiosks at which farmers can get 20, 30 pub services from the government, no longer having to go stand in line, no longer have to pay a middleman, because technology allows that to be much more directly accessible, whether it's a printing of a birth certificate, a land title, marriage certificate, etc. So in the sense of public service delivery, I would say that citizens have been much more empowered by technology, including the digitization of records, making them more amenable to freedom of information requests. In India, we call it the right to information, RTI, as well. So those, I think, are the positive and, you know, quite obvious. We are, in a sense, because of the communications, and WhatsApp has been in the news quite a bit, and Facebook because of the role of disinformation in South Asia. I mean, literally the WhatsApp changes to the number of people you can forward a message to in one go. It's now limited to 5 people at a time, right? It was made in response to the Indian elections, where mass WhatsApps were being sent to spread rumors that were being linked to the onset of violence, you know, riots against minority communities, etc. So how to regulate that information landscape means that the technology companies are so far ahead of the governments that have to deal with them that we either get very ham-handed approaches or we get pretty imperfect kind of ones. On this, I think the question of privacy is going to be the critical one. And so maybe I'll close with that. The breaking story in the Indian press over the last 24 hours has been the revelation that someone, we don't know who yet, used state-of-the-art Israeli spyware to monitor the WhatsApp chats of a couple of dozen significant civil society leaders and journalists, right? Apparently, this is extremely state-of-the-art. I mean, the supposition or the allegation is that the government has something to do with this, right? But in a world in which, right, so much of this is being done over WhatsApp, so much of it is being done electronically, the ability of governments to monitor journalists and to constrain free speech is something that I think we're going to have to keep an eye on, because that technology is evolving so rapidly, both in terms of our ability to be a little hidden from government, to organize on social media, but also government's response to that is to find new surveillance technologies. So in that sense, we're in a brave new world, right? But it's undeniable that technology has both brought governments much closer to people in terms of service delivery, while maybe having some deleterious effects on the quality of information, the quality of conversations, and the polarization of society.
Similarly, Facebook has just announced that they suspended three account networks, which were linked to, I think, over 200 accounts and 1 million people influencing or interfering in domestic politics in Africa, including supporting parties, candidates, or promoting special interest, and linked to a Russian financier. So technology could both, or technology represent both a unique opportunity to advance democratic development, but also can pose a risk if countries do not take the appropriate policy measures to prevent such disinformation and manipulations.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time. Let me just ask real super brief answers from our panelists. Yeah. We've talked a little bit about the year that's behind us now. What are you going to be looking for in 2020 in terms of the indicators that tell us something about the health of democracy in the regions that you're focusing on? Like, what should we be looking for in the coming year and paying attention to? We'll start with you, Irfan. What should we look for?
The most immediate is this election that's coming in Sri Lanka. And I think we got to keep an eye on it. There's a real concern that this, as I said, is going to be fought on pretty significant ethnic lines. There's a number of ruling families, right, who have multiple members. There's some 12 candidates running for president, three from the same family. So this doesn't bode well. We should keep an eye on that. And I want to just make sure we mention Afghanistan, right? As a South Asianist, I'll be a little imperial, and we'll claim Afghanistan as South Asia. That's how it is at the Atlantic Council, where I also have an affiliation. But what's happened in Afghanistan is just is sad, right? I mean, well, this election both represents the incredible bravery and commitment to democracy of the Afghan people. I'm not sure I would have gone and voted, given the risks to voting that are there, but a low turnout and now a set of results that have been delayed significantly in a way that's going to undermine the legitimacy of the results one way or the other. And so I think those are the two that I would ask all of you to pay attention to.
Great. Julie, what about Latin America?
There is no election to see because they are almost over. So now we are going to have to take attention of how this new cycle evolves. I will say two things that we need to pay more attention. One is the impact of the lack of regulation of platform economies and the impact on the labor market. I think it's something we have many, many people now in Latin America working as independent workers for these platforms, and it's part of a very different type of an informal economy in Latin America. I think that is going to impact on democracy and on attitudes toward democracy. And another trend in society that will have an impact on democracy is whether we go on regulating the use of Facebook or the use of how we regulate algorithms, and what is Latin America going to do about that. That is, now it's quite an absent discussion, although Europe is working on that. There's a lot of debate in other countries. In Latin America, there's no debate about how we should go on with that.
Big issue in lots of places these days, yeah. Landry, what about Africa?
So I would think that there are a couple of things One is to watch carefully at all the political or popular mobilization that we'll have on the continent. So we may have a downfall of more authoritarian leaders than people think. So watch very closely. Mm. So the second point is to invest in state capacity. I guess you'll be very happy. But also in political party institutionalization, because without the institutionalization of political party, we cannot be going far, as well as on cyber security, because most of the African, the website of most of the African governments, including some from presidencies and ministers or ministries of interior, central banks, could be hacked in a matter of minutes. So cyber security will be very critical, and that it doesn't just concern Africans, but also anyone else engaging with Africa. So we are all concerned. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you. Thanks again to Brookings and CPEC. Thanks to all of you for coming. And join me in a round of applause for thanking all of our panelists.